Council. Also, Craig Voland with the Sierra Club will speak to us about mercury pollution. But first, I have your news. As a part of the Sunday Review, the New York Times reports the toxic brew in our yards. The United States Fish and Wildlife Service says homeowners use up to 10 times more chemicals per acre than farmers do. Some of these chemicals rub off on children or pets, but most are washed with rainwater into our streams, lakes, and rivers, or are absorbed into our groundwater. These are the sources of our drinking water, and tests show these chemicals are indeed contaminating our water supply. These chemicals are not safe just because they are available in stores. What we put on our lawns and down our drains winds up in our drinking water and is not removed by water treatment. Bottled water is not a solution because it comes from the same sources and is susceptible to the same contaminants. But if we don't put these chemicals in our yards, they won't be in our drinking water. The last decade or so, plenty of homeowners have been rejecting the emerald green lawn and planting with species that do not demand chemicals and constant watering. But not nearly enough of us have taken that step. We need to see a perfect lawn not as enviable, but as a sign of harm. The Washington Post reports Supreme Court upholds EPA rule limiting cross-state pollution. The Supreme Court on Tuesday resurrected an EPA rule targeting air pollution that drifts across state borders, handing the Obama administration a victory on one of its major environmental efforts. The agency for years, under two administrations, has struggled to carry out a directive under the Federal Clean Air Act to protect downwind states from pollutants generated in other states, mostly from coal-fired power plants. The EPA's rules from 2011 were challenged by a coalition of upwind states and industry, which prevailed in lower courts. But the Supreme Court ruled 6-2 that the latest effort could be implemented, with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg writing for the majority that the agency must have leeway to confront the, quote, complex challenge, end quote, of interstate pollution. Quote, most upwind states propel pollutants to more than one downwind state. Many downwind states receive pollution from multiple upwind states, and some states qualify as both upwind and downwind, she wrote. The overlapping and interwoven linkages between upwind and downwind states with which EPA had to contend number in the thousands, end quote. EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy called the ruling, quote, a resounding victory for public health and a key component of the agency's effort to make sure all Americans have clean air to breathe, end quote. She said the court's decision underscored the importance of basing clean air rules on strong legal foundations and sound science, declaring it a big win and a proud day for the agency. And that's all for the news.
All right. Thank you very much, Naturally. Good evening. My name is Mike Murphy, and we're another Monday evening with Eco Radio KC. So on Saturday, May 17th, Kansas City will join communities around the country to ask President Obama and local officials to reject the Keystone XL pipeline, offshore drilling, and other dirty fuel projects that threaten our communities and destabilize our climate. And so here to talk about that is an event scheduled on Saturday. John Kerman is here, who's no stranger to this program. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Mike. Thanks for asking me to come back again.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Always love to hear your insights. First of all, give us the title of the rally, because that's quite a mouthful in itself.
Yeah. Well, so the rallies were originally thought of as a sort of solidarity rallies with a big rally that was held on April 26th called Reject and Protect that was led by the Cowboy Indian Alliance. And we talked about that last time I was on the show. An unusual name there. You don't think of cowboys and Indians allying on much of anything. But they did. They have built an alliance over fighting this Keystone XL pipeline, because if this thing is built, it will run through ranchers' land, farmers' land, and tribal lands, and it will threaten the water supply of the Ogallala Aquifer, which everyone out in the plains pretty much is dependent on one way or another. So despite whatever past differences cowboys and Indians have had, they certainly are united in their opposition to construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, which, for listeners who haven't heard this on the show in the past, is a pipeline that would ship diluted bitumen, which is this gunk in the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, that if you use enough energy and want to deal with enough nasty pollutants, you can turn into a form of synthetic crude oil that can be used in the same way conventional crude oil can. But it does take considerably more energy to do it. And, of course, if it takes considerably more energy, that means considerably more carbon pollution to pollute the climate and heat-trapping gases that are contributing to the climate crisis. But it was decided that the organizers, the Cowboy Indian Alliance, Bold Nebraska, 350.org, did not want to distract from the march and rally in Washington, D.C., happening on April 26, and there were 4 days leading up to that as well of actions and an encampment on the National Mall. They didn't want to distract from that with the solidarity rallies around the country, so it was decided to do follow-up rallies instead on May 17th, which it was also realized is the annual Hands Across the Sand, Hands Across the Land event, which started back up in 2010, originally just to oppose offshore oil drilling in general, and then, as I imagine many listeners will recall, the Deepwater Horizon, BP's Deepwater Horizon oil rig blew in April of 2010 and spewed oil all the way into, was it July, something like that, over 200 million gallons of oil spilled into the Gulf. And so it became an annual event, and it happened to fall on May 17th. So the Tar Sands Coalition, the National Tar Sands Coalition, and the Hands Across the Sand Land folks have united to have this national event. And here in Kansas City, 350KC, the organization I'm with, is sponsoring a rally that we have brought into it the idea of fighting big oil's pollution of our democracy, how the power, the financial power, the lobbying power of the big oil companies and the other dirty fuels companies have really corrupted our democratic process for well over 100 years now. Have made it impossible for us to get in place the kinds of policies, the kinds of regulations we need to deal with the air and water pollution from fossil fuels. And as it's become increasingly clear that our biggest problem with fossil fuels is the carbon pollution, to get in place the policies we need to rein that in and avert a climate catastrophe. So we here locally, we are going to have someone, yours truly, Mike Murphy, dress up to portray Uncle Sam. We're going to oil Sam up with a simulation of crude oil, and then we're going to have a clean energy cleansing, a ritual cleansing. Of course, Uncle Sam has always been the embodiment of the U.S. government, the federal government, which is so thoroughly polluted with big oil money that it's disgusting and horrifying. So we're going to do a ritual cleansing of Uncle Sam, and then we're going to march through the plaza down Cleaver 2 Boulevard there to Warnell and over to the pedestrian bridge over Brush Creek. And at the pedestrian bridge, we're going to join hands across the pedestrian bridge because that's the central image of the Hands Across the Sand, Hands Across the Land movement, of folks joining hands to protect whatever they love, the beach, the rivers, the land, the Ogallala Aquifer, from big oil and other fossil fuel pollution. So that's the idea behind the rally. That's what we'll be doing here in Kansas City in cooperation with the Sierra Club, the Heartland Renewable Energy Society, and we're inviting lots of other organizations to turn out their members to groups like Move to Amend that are very concerned with corporate power and corporate control over our government, what with the Supreme Court decisions ruling that corporations are people of all ridiculous things. We're getting MoveOn.org involved in it. They're not a co-sponsor, but they're going to help us turn people out for it. And we're hoping to get as many organizations as possible because, you know, the climate crisis, at the root of things, you can say growth is our fundamental problem. But the climate crisis is the most pressing manifestation of our problem of growth because it's different from the other ecological crises we face because of the long lag time between when you take action and when the problem begins to ease, because carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for so long and it traps heat for as long as it's in the atmosphere, hundreds to thousands of years. So the carbon that we've put into the atmosphere today, even if we stop putting any more carbon, which of course is impossible to do without a complete collapse of global civilization, will go on warming the planet for hundreds to thousands of years into the future. So it's really, that's kind of why it's been called a wicked problem, is because we really need to act before the consequences become undeniably clear. We sort of have to understand the science well enough to understand what's going to happen if we don't act now, even though the worst consequences aren't happening now. We're seeing consequences, but the worst is yet to come, as they say.
Well, thanks for cheering us up there, pal.
I know that's always why you invite me on, because yeah. I'm Johnny Sunshine.
So there's a lot to bite on there. All right. So you mentioned briefly the threat to the Ogallala that the XL mm-hmm. pipeline. In a sentence or two, explain what the Ogallala is. Just let's not make any assumptions that everyone knows what that is.
Yeah. So the Ogallala Aquifer is this huge underground water source. It's an aquifer. Some aquifers are fossil aquifers. They're not recharged at all by rainfall. The Ogallala Aquifer is recharged by rainfall slowly, much more slowly than we're actually draining it right now to provide water to cattle and farms and cities and all that sort of thing. But the concern is, and I don't pretend to be knowledgeable enough about hydrology to feel competent in saying how great the threat is if there was a major spill from this Keystone XL pipeline where it passes over the Ogallala Aquifer. But the folks who live, many of the folks who live out there in the area and rely on the Ogallala Aquifer are tremendously concerned about the risk. And it's, it provides drinking water to, please don't hold me to this, my memory could be faulty, but I think it's something like 2 million people, mm-hmm. as well as the water that's provided to farms and the ranchers, again, mm-hmm. that they provide to their livestock. It's a tremendously important source of water in the Great Plains because it's such a dry place otherwise. There's not a great deal of rainfall in most of the Great Plains. So this underground aquifer is an essential to agriculture there, to farming there. Now, one could argue that maybe we shouldn't be doing so much farming there. Maybe we shouldn't be doing and raising so many cattle there. That's a perfectly valid point, but the people who are out there doing it are extremely concerned about the threat right. to the Ogallala Aquifer. And there's other water. You know, this Keystone XL pipeline, if it's built, it's going to cross the Missouri River and the now I'm blanking on what the river is that's a tributary of the Missouri
the
that
Platte?
It's going to cross. Yeah, it's the Platte. Yeah, it's going to cross both of those if the northern leg of Keystone XL is built, as well as multiple other rivers, streams, creeks. It's a major threat to the water supply. One study found that a major spill into the Platte River would contaminate the Missouri River all the way to Kansas City. And, of course, where do we get our drinking water? The vast majority of our drinking water here in Kansas City comes out of the Missouri River. It's a significant threat. Now, of course, you never know when a new pipeline is going to have a major spill. It might not be for decades, but it'll probably happen at some point.
Because they do. Because we're hearing about pipeline mm-hmm. leaks all
pipelines,
the time now.
Pipelines inevitably spill. You know, so there's this Keystone XL pipeline, but the first Keystone pipeline, which after they proposed Keystone XL was redubbed Keystone 1, has been in place since 2010, I believe it is. My understanding is it spilled. Now, they weren't major spills, but it spilled something like 12 or 13 times in the first year of operation. And as these things age, spills become more likely. It's inevitably a consequence. There's no way to produce and transport fossil fuels without spills, without leaks. There are different issues with different fossil fuels, but they always end up polluting the air and the water just by being used. There is no really completely safe way. That's why they're dirty fuels. And at one time, you know, maybe it was inevitable and unavoidable that we would use these because they are tremendously energy dense and we weren't able to build solar photovoltaic panels or massive wind turbines that can produce significant amounts of energy, but we can now. There's no excuse for continuing to do this. And that goes back to big oil's pollution of our democracy. Why aren't we making the clean energy transition? Well, fossil fuels don't reflect their true costs in pollution because we can't get the regulations in place we need to internalize those costs. That's an economist term. I know it's kind of boring, but that's what we need to do. When we pay for fossil fuels, what we pay should reflect their real costs in air and water pollution and climate pollution and all of those sorts of things. It's this big oil pollution of our democracy, the lobbying power, how they shape who gets elected and therefore who's in there to vote for laws or against laws that we need to change.
So, I mean, you mentioned, again, we're talking about a rally that's coming up this coming Saturday at 2 p.m., mm-hmm. But you mentioned that you're taking a wider approach than just the XL pipeline. You mentioned, for example, offshore drilling.
Right.
But I hear people, in fact, that may have been Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, I heard say that, like, the XL pipeline is the big one. Like, if this goes through, it's game over. I don't know.
Well, that goes back to something James Hansen, who's one of the most renowned climate scientists in the world, said. He said a few years ago that what he said was not specifically the Keystone XL pipeline, but that if the bitumen in the tar sands in Canada was fully exploited, that would be, quote, game over for the climate. Now, the reason Keystone XL is important is because it would allow a significant increase in production from the tar sands. Now, they're trying to build pipelines to every coast there is. Where this stuff is in Canada is landlocked. And to increase production, they need to be able to get it to the world market, which means being able to get it to a coast where it can be refined and then shipped on these huge tanker ships. So the Keystone XL pipeline by itself is not game over for the climate. But the reason the Keystone XL pipeline fight was picked was one, it cuts, if built, it cuts right through the heart of the United States. And so it affects a large number of people in the United States, and that's where this movement is focused and based right now. And the other thing is the person who has the decision-making power, the people who have the decision-making power on this, are people we actually have some leverage with, the Obama administration. Ultimately, this is President Obama's decision. The fact of the matter is if we could get the kind of policies we need, for example, a price on carbon so that, again, fossil fuels reflect their real climate costs, through Congress, there wouldn't be any need to fight the Keystone XL pipeline specifically, because a price on carbon would mean tar sands would be too expensive for people to afford to buy, and there would be no reason to expand them, and we'd be moving on a clean energy transition, and that would be wonderful. But in case the listeners haven't noticed, we have a lot of people in Congress who don't even accept that the climate is being disrupted. So the chances of getting a price on carbon passed through Congress are absolutely zero. So what do? We can't get the policies we really need. So we have to pick fights that will build, that one, we can get some victories. Again, this is a fight where we have leverage over the guys who are going to make the decision, John Kerry, Secretary of State, President Obama, because they've said great things about how they're going to deal with climate, so we can hold them to their words on this thing. And two, pick fights that will allow us to build a movement that's big enough to either force the folks in Congress to change their minds or force them out of Congress and get people in there who are ready to act. And given the gridlock in Congress, those are really the only alternatives we have. We can fight for good regulations, and that's all well and good. You know, I'm to a limited degree involved in the fight for new regulations on carbon pollution from coal-fired power plants, existing and new, and that's great. If you look just at the numbers, those will have a bigger impact than stopping Keystone XL will. But you can't build a movement over regulations, fighting for good regulations. That doesn't get people energized. Movements are driven by outrage.
What do we
anger.
Want? Stricter regulations.
You know, you're just not going to get people in the streets for that. And crucially, that is the absolutely most important thing we must do, is to build a climate movement that's strong enough, that has enough political muscle to win, to defeat those who won't even admit and probably don't even actually believe, most of them, I think, they actually do not believe that the climate crisis is a real problem. And that's for ideological reasons. I don't know that we have any time to get into that. But I honestly think that for ideological reasons, they literally cannot accept the evidence, as overwhelming as it is, that we are disrupting the climate, because it threatens their ideas about how the world should work, about how, what kind of an economy we should have, and the absolute goodness of economic growth, and on and on and on. It disrupts, it goes against their entire worldview, and they literally cannot see the facts because of that. That's the way I understand it.
So you said a couple minutes ago that ultimately this is President Obama's call. Mm-hmm. Now, there was it a vote last week in the Senate?
They haven't actually taken a vote. There's been a push for a vote to take the decision out of President Obama's hands. So just to give a little background, the reason that this decision is made by the Obama administration is because Keystone XL, if built, would cross the Canada-U.S. border. And any infrastructure that would cross the border has to be approved by the State Department, is the way the process actually works. The State Department has to make a determination that it's in the national interest for this infrastructure crossing the border to be built. Realistically, though, and President Obama has made this clear in his public statements, that it's his decision. The State Department's not going to make any decision that President Obama doesn't want them to make. After all, they're part of his administration. So that's why. Now, it is possible, of course, for the Congress to pass a law that would take this decision out of President Obama's hands and just approve it. And there have been various efforts over the last few years to do that, and there's one currently underway. Last I heard on the news today, so Senator Harry Reid, who's the majority leader of the Senate, had said if Republicans will allow a vote, allow this energy efficiency bill that's currently pending before the Senate to go forward without a filibuster, he would allow a standalone vote on Keystone XL. Now, whether or not they have enough votes to pass legislation that would take the decision out of President Obama's hands is up in the air. But the Republicans are unhappy because the Democrats supposedly aren't allowing them to make propose amendments to the energy efficiency bill. So they're not going to support the energy efficiency bill vote going forward. If that doesn't happen, there'll be no vote on Keystone XL either. They're playing politics with this vote over this. The chances that they would get a supermajority of 67 votes, which is what they would need to override a veto from President Obama, and he would veto any legislation that tried to take the Keystone XL decision out of his hands. The chances of getting those 67 votes are pretty darn slim. Sadly, both of our senators here in Missouri, if there was a vote, would vote to take the bill out of, or the decision out of President Obama's hands, and
as well as both senators
Keystone
in
XL,
Kansas.
And obviously both senators in Kansas would do that. The big disappointment, of course, is Claire McCaskill. I mean, we know Roberts and, I have trouble remembering the
name. Moran?
Moran in Kansas. I have trouble remembering his name. And Blunt in Missouri. I mean, no one is surprised that they're in favor of Keystone XL, But you would like to think that Claire would. I saw a friend of mine forward me one of the form letters she got in response to a comment she sent in to Senator McCaskill outlining McCaskill's position on Keystone XL. And sadly, she's drunk the Kool-Aid of the pro-Keystone XL supporters. And she's bought their argument about how it would help us be more energy independent, and even the idea that it would lower gasoline prices, which is completely the opposite of what would be the case here in the Midwest. Building Keystone XL would actually increase gasoline prices. It was sad to read. But
yeah, it seemed like I looked at her website, and it seemed all over the website. This You know, the, and the one case I saw that she made was that, well, the tar sands are going to be extracted either way, whether it comes through this pipeline or not. So why not get in on the action? You know, that wasn't her words.
Right. Certainly that argument has been made, and it's possible. It's possible even if President Obama rejects Keystone XL, but enough pipelines will be built going other ways, not through the U.S., that the same amount of tar sands would be produced and the same amount of carbon pollution would end up in the atmosphere. But the analogy I made to that is like, so, you know, a friend comes to you, and Canada has long been a friend of the United States. A friend comes to you and says, I'm going to shoot this guy in the head. I can do it myself, but it'd be easier if you'd help me.
You're right.
Would you say, well, he's going to do it anyway, I might as well help him? No.
Yeah.
Hopefully you'd say no and try and talk him out of it, right? That argument is just, and that's the same conclusion, essentially, that the State Department came to in its final supplemental environmental impact statement on Keystone XL, is this stuff's going to get to market and be burned one way or another, so we don't really need to worry about the climate consequences of Keystone XL. But I don't think that's the case.
So is this a foregone conclusion on the Canadian side of the border? Is this, or, you know?
There's no, I mean, it has all the necessary approvals in Canada, so it would be built in there. Now, other pipeline proposals in Canada are being fiercely fought. The Northern Gateway proposal that would go to the British Columbian coast to the west, and TransCanada, the same company that wants to build Keystone XL, has another proposal called Energy East to convert an existing pipeline and build some new pipelines to go to the east coast of Canada. Those are being fiercely fought. But I don't think there's much question of Canadian approval. Although it's interesting, Canada's different than what they call First Nations, or we would call American Indian peoples, there in Canada, under the Canadian Constitution, as I understand it, have more authority over their lands than American Indians have over their reservation lands here in the U.S. So I don't know. It might be possible that they would put up a serious legal fight there if President Obama approves this thing. But right now what it's hinging on is what President Obama does.
But there's still this issue. We've just got a couple minutes left in this. There's still this issue. There's a pending court case in Nebraska that was done against the Nebraska state constitution?
It was ruled recently by a court in Nebraska that the way in which Governor Heineman's administration in Nebraska approved the reroute, which was intended to at least mostly avoid the sensitive Sandhills area, the way in which that was approved was unconstitutional. Now, that court fight is going on. Of course, the government of Nebraska has appealed that decision, but that was the reasoning that the Obama administration, the State Department, gave for delaying their decision on Keystone XL indefinitely. That and the fact that they got over 2 million comments on the final supplemental environmental impact statement. That's going to take a while to process.
November election is also another.
Certainly, they didn't say it, but there are certainly those, because whichever way President Obama goes on this, it's going to hurt some Democrats' election prospects, whichever way he goes on it. So there's good reason to think politics probably played a role in it, too. But I know we need to wrap up, but I want to make sure we get the final details. So, you know, I said earlier that the most essential thing we need to do is build a climate movement. Well, folks, you out there listening, that means we need you to get moving, too. We need you to show up, if at all possible, at 2 p.m. on Saturday, J.C. Nichols Fountain, right there at Cleaver 2 Boulevard and J.C. Nichols Parkway on the plaza. We're going to start there. We're going to cleanse Mike Murphy as Uncle Sam. You guys want to see us throw water on Mike Murphy, don't you? Then we're going to march through the plaza to the pedestrian bridge. It should be fun. We're going to have a mock pipeline, some End Big Oil's Democracy Pollution signs, and Reject Keystone XL. And we sure hope folks will come out and join us and take part. You can find us on Facebook through the 350KC Facebook page and RSVP for the event.
So you can RSVP via the Facebook event.
Yeah. So you can tell us whether you're coming or not.
And the local website is 350kc.org.
Yep, that's our local website.
All right. Well, John, I hope you can stick around. And
I will do.
We talked with Craig about mercury, but we've got a couple of messages to play here on Eco Radio KC. We'll be back.
on Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m., World Fair Trade Day. Learn exactly what fair trade labels mean. Hear stories from volunteers who travel to other countries to see firsthand how fair trade makes a positive difference in the lives and communities of artisans and small farmers, and learn how you can participate in the fair trade movement. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m.
Wednesday was an historic day.
It was?
Hey, this is your old pal Mike Murphy. You know, I was born on Wednesday, and I'm here to tell you that this Wednesday's child is full of whoa. So join me each and every Wednesday morning until 8 a.m. for music from around the world and around the block. Your Wednesday morning buzz, going 10 years strong.
The wonder of it all, baby.
On Wednesday, all the malls across America connected.
I think that sports is a really amazing lens to look at and to understand the history of black politics and resistance in this country. Like, you can tell the history through sports.
That's Dave Zirin speaking of sports on the next Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9.
The Left Forum draws thousands every year to New York City to hear a constellation of thinkers and activists. On the next Sprouts, we hear some of those luminaries, including Medea Benjamin, Michael Moore, Jill Stein, Noam Chomsky, and Oliver Stone. Sprouts, Thursday at noon.
All right, here we are back in the studio at KKFI on Eco Radio KC. Thanks for joining us this evening. Joining us here in the studio now is Craig Vollen, longtime environmental activist. Craig's with the Sierra Club and has been in this fight for a very long time. And he's here this evening to talk to us about mercury and mercury pollution. And so welcome to the show, Craig. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're always a font of information, so we're glad to have you on here. So when did mercury become an important issue?
It became an important issue in the 1960s in Japan. There was a chemical company that was discharging to the Minamata Bay, the name of the bay there, and this mercury got into the fish and caused enormous problems with the population there. And it became a worldwide. There was some really heartbreaking photos that were sent around the world of the babies born to the mothers that had eaten the fish, and they were terribly mutated. They were a lot of them actually died from it. So that was when it became a big deal.
And that's like, what year was that?
It was in the 1960s.
Oh, that early. So that's when the term mercury poisoning, like that term,
right,
probably didn't exist before that. Or
nobody thought about it.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. And so are we talking about the stuff in the thermometer, like the silver, quicksilver?
No. That's what most that I'm really here to talk about. The inorganic forms, or what's also called elemental mercury, that you're used to looking at in thermometers, is toxic, but at a much higher level than methyl mercury. Methyl mercury is toxic to the most sensitive receptor, which is the fetus, at 0.2 of 1 millionth of an ounce. If you can imagine how small that is, 0.2 of 1 millionth of an ounce per day of eating that in terms of fish. And methyl, nobody actually manufactures methyl mercury. It is essentially made in the environment. It's made in water bodies by bacteria. So the problem is that the inorganic forms of mercury get into these water bodies where the animals at the very low end of the food chain change it to this highly toxic form, and then it goes up into the food chain, and the highest level of fish, which you might call the predator fish, like around here would be bass or walleye, get the highest amount in it. And so methylmercury is
in my experience, the single most potent and toxic substance I know of. Perhaps plutonium is worse, but it is on that scale of toxicity. And so that's why it's a very insidious problem, because we have been doing things, and this is why it's the stepchild or the little brother of climate change, because it's really a parallel development that started in earnest with the Industrial Revolution. So this very the causes of it, of the higher level that we now have, where it's reached the threshold of harm and beyond, is exactly the same as the greenhouse gases and climate change problem.
Okay, so you've been on this program before. I haven't really heard you mention mercury pollution before. Why now? Why are you involved in this now?
Well, the immediate reason is because in Kansas, where I do most of my work, the Kansas Department of Health and Environment just last year increased the advisory to people about eating fish on account of mercury. Previously, they had said you could eat any of the freshwater fish in Kansas pretty much one meal a week and be okay, and now they're saying just one meal a month. Well, that was already the case in Missouri. So it kind of brought me back to the work I did some 25 years ago where I first got involved in the mercury issue. It's because in 1989 I was interested in promoting recycling, and a company, I guess it was Kansas City Power and Light, proposed to build what they called a mass burn garbage incinerator here. A lot of people won't remember this, but we knew that if this a mass burn garbage incinerator is, they take all the garbage, they don't separate anything out, they don't recycle anything, they throw it all in the hopper and burn it. And here was this inside the box thinking, well, it seems to be very efficient. We just do one thing, and all we have to do is worry about coming out of the stack. Well, I noticed in their paperwork that they were not going to remove the mercury. Well, it's one thing to burn paper. You know, all you have to do is worry about the ash. There's nothing particularly toxic in it. But if you burn everything else, you're talking about not only mercury, but cadmium, lead, chromium. They're all used, for example, in pigments. Well, if they're encased in plastic, as say the color red, case of mercury, or the color orange was cadmium, lead was blue or white, depending on the compound, they're not going to hurt anybody. But if you burn them, then you release them up into the air. And so I noticed that, well, they're not removing this mercury, so what? The EPA didn't seem to care. So I started researching it, and I found that in the United States, they were only looking at companies that were dumping mercury into streams and rivers. And they weren't even thinking about where else this mercury was coming from. But in Europe, they had discovered, particularly the Swedes, had watched all of a sudden, and not all of a sudden, but they had begun to test their fish and fish-eating birds and found all this methylmercury. Well, they didn't have chemical companies and very much industry. So all of a sudden they said, where could this be coming from? And so I went to the very first international conference on mercury as a global pollutant in 1990 in Sweden to find out what they knew about where this mercury was coming from. And it turned out it was coming up from mainland Europe and Central Europe, where they had very dirty industry at the time. So I realized that the vast majority of the mercury was actually coming in from the atmosphere. And this was happening all over the world, wherever they were burning garbage or industrial waste or, in particular, coal. There's a lot. There's some in oil, as a matter of fact, not much in natural gas. Well, there's none in natural gas. So that's when I realized we went on to, at the time I started working on this, there were 150 mass burn incinerators proposed by many of the major cities in America, And along with some other people, we managed to defeat all but about five of those. And it was because not only of mercury pollution, but dioxins, which was another consequence of not thinking about what you're doing. Because when you burn any organic substance in the presence of chlorine, you get dioxin and all manner of nasty chlorinated organics, which are all very toxic, PCBs and so on. So that's how I got started in it, on it. And since then, we've burned a heck of a lot of coal. And so it's gotten to past the threshold of harm. And so that's why I'm talking about it. I'm going to talk about it at the All Souls Forum this Sunday, if you're interested in getting more detail on it. But I also want to talk about here, maybe give John a chance if he's got a question.
Oh, I was just curious. Did the Kansas Department of Health and Environment give a rationale for this really significant change in their health advisory to go from saying you can eat these top predator fish once a week safely to saying don't eat them more than once a month?
No, they didn't specifically, but I happen to know because I was asking for their database all along. That I believe the reason was because they changed the method in which they were measuring mercury in the fish. Previously, they would catch a particular species of 3 to 5 individuals. Then they would slice them up and blend them together, and you would get an average number, say 300 parts per billion. Well, the EPA threshold of harm for sensitive individuals is 230 parts per billion. So anyway, you would look at these numbers, and they wouldn't be like really that much higher. And we're talking the top predators here, bass primarily. Well, then all of a sudden they came up with actually a good idea. Instead of killing the fish, they would take a plug out of them, little tiny plug, and they would test that. So for the first time, you were getting the results by individual. And some of these numbers were 600-700 parts per billion. And I noticed this just the last 2-3 years. I said, holy smokes, those are really toxic fish there. And this is Kansas, you know. This is not like the industrial heartland. So I think that's the reason that they made this change, but they didn't want to, you know, panic anybody.
At the same time, isn't it true that the science has been moving in the direction of lowering what the safe threshold is on mercury? I mean, realistically, is there really a safe level of mercury exposure?
Well, that's subject to some debate, but you're right. That's a good question because I think in 2001, the EPA decided that the limit in fish was 230 parts per billion. And that included a 10-times safety factor, which is a very common method they use to establish thresholds for toxics. Well, the latest research indicates that the real threshold without a safety factor is 230 parts per billion. So all the new research using, you know, more precise methods has identified that children whose mothers ate a significant amount of fish that were polluted actually had these decrements in, it's a neurotoxin, so decrements in motor ability, in memory. They were finding these things at much lower levels. Now, ironically, and this is the complexity of this issue, other scientists are finding that mothers, pregnant mothers who eat fish with omega-3 and DHA, a type of omega-3, actually increase the baby's ability, their brains, to do these things. So you got this conflict. Where the debate is now, the EPA and FDA have lined up with the seafood industry to say, we want pregnant women to eat more fish. Say, well, then the environmental groups and lots of scientists at the universities that have followed this would say, not so fast, because we don't have good enough data on what the mercury really is in these fish. Now, the FDA would agree, well, you don't want people out there eating marlin. These are really top of the food chain fish or shark.
Swordfish.
Yeah, but it's okay to eat tilapia, for example, or Salmon is one, actually, that most people, both sides agree on is good to eat. But tilapia, for example, has almost no omega-3 in it. It's a right. very popular fish now.
Because it's a farmed fish. It's not a marine fish. It's a wild-caught right. fish that from the ocean that have omega-3s.
Exactly.
Which is why farmed salmon are not really high in omega-3s either. You have to get wild-caught salmon.
Yeah, almost everybody agrees wild-caught salmon is good, but if that word gets around, then it will wipe out the ocean. So it's a very complex issue as to what people should do. People who are not female and pregnant or possibly get pregnant have a little more leeway in what they eat. But personally, I've never liked fish that much anyway, so it's not that big a deal. But after really investigating this further, I don't see a reason to eat a lot of fish unless you are a well-educated, when I mean educated meaning specifically on this subject, a female who is pregnant or might be pregnant. I think there is some reason to eat fish, but you better know what you're doing. And I'm going to talk about that some on Sunday, that there's a lot of sources out there, the Environmental Defense Fund, Environmental Working Group have recently done really good reports. What they discovered is that the FDA's database is not very good, that they have underestimated the amount of mercury in those fish that they were recommending you eat. Mm. So if I were about to get pregnant or pregnant, I would do a lot of research on the web.
If you were pregnant, Craig, you should see a healthcare professional.
That's right. Well,
Craig, I think you're too old to get pregnant.
I hope so.
Hey, we'll get some links to those guides that tell you which fish have the highest levels of mercury pollution. And there's other issues, too, like PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, that are another
right.
big issue with fish as well. We'll get links to those guides up on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page. But before we want to run out of time, Craig, one question we need you to answer is, yes, it's important to figure out what's safe to eat, but more important in my view than that is to figure out how can we stop contributing to this problem? Because this stuff lingers. This stuff doesn't biodegrade.
Right, and this is where it's very similar to what you were just saying earlier about climate change. This mercury, once it deposits, actually is re-emitted. And so a large part of the mercury in the atmosphere today was mercury that was deposited 200 years ago. And it keeps getting – there's a thing called the mercury cycle. And they estimate that it'll take – if we quit today – it would take 2,000 years for the mercury to fall out of the system, which means it goes down in the sediment, gets covered up. So what did we do? This is very similar to what humans did to create the climate change. Mercury is a very volatile metal, and it seems like a contradiction that metals can be volatile. And this one is. It's a very high vapor pressure. So what happened was, hundreds of millions of years ago, there was mercury when the Earth, during hot periods, the mercury would be floating around in the atmosphere. Well, then it would be, it actually is breathed in by plants and attaches to plants. So what happened was, and it also loves to be attached to sulfur. So any source of sulfur it would attach to, and it went out of the system. The plants died, the plants got covered up. Over millions of years, those plants turned into
fossil fuels, oil and coal.
Okay, so we created the mercury problem by digging all that sequestered mercury up,
along with all that sequestered carbon,
right, and sticking it back in the air. Now here's really the key point. There's some marine mammals out there like whales and seals that have very high levels of mercury that doesn't seem to affect them. That's because they evolved with relatively high levels in the ocean. Okay, humans came onto the scene very recently in geological time, and we did not evolve any defenses against all this mercury that we're putting back in the air. So that's why it's so toxic to humans is because we didn't live with it for a million years.
Right.
And so it's very similar. It's really the consequence of excessive industrialization and consumption and a lack of consideration of what we were doing. So it's very similar to the climate change
problem. So what are the kinds of individual choices we can make? Obviously, it's not enough. We need laws to deal with this, and there have been some recent improvements in regulation of mercury and other air toxics from coal-fired power plants. But I would say they're certainly not where they should be. We need to be pushing for that. We need big systemic changes to deal with this problem. But in the meantime, what can individuals do themselves that will limit how much they're contributing to this? I mean, the most obvious thing to me, you say coal is a major source.
Right.
Well,
mm-hmm.
be efficient with your use of electricity, since the vast
right.
majority of electricity mm-hmm. in Kansas and Missouri still comes from coal. But are there other things?
Fortunately or unfortunately, how you look at it, in Kansas City, we're not burning our waste. And so you can, if you have an old mercury switch, you could actually look at there's ways you can, there's also mercury in some fluorescent lights. You can recycle these, which will help a little bit, although even if they get into a landfill, it's a low temperature environment, and that's inorganic forms that are unlikely to get in a place where they'll change. But just don't, just be careful if you have an old mercury switch, for example.
How would you know if it was a mercury switch?
Well, any of the old thermostats are all, they just would switch with a
mm-hmm.
mercury. That's another thing it does, it conducts electricity very well, and so it was used in those switches. I think the main thing is to quit burning so much coal. Now, as far as globally is concerned, one of the biggest sources that remains is the small-scale gold mining, where they actually use this elemental mercury to latch on to small amounts of gold. Then they burn it off, and it goes in the atmosphere. So don't buy any gold. That'd be another way of doing it.
Yeah, and the reason they do that is because all the big deposits of gold are gone, so they have to mine huge quantities of the
right.
earth that have tiny amounts of gold in them and use the mercury to separate the little bits of gold from this great majority of material that isn't gold. Gold.
Well, we have to give these. Unfortunately, there's 100 million people involved in what they call artisanal gold mining. And these are very poor people. So we need to somehow, if we're going to get them off of doing this with getting bits of gold to survive, then we've got to give them an alternative.
We are running out of time. Now, Craig will be at the All Souls Forum, which is the 10 o'clock on Sunday.
Yeah, 10 o'clock.
And All Souls is at 4501
Walnut.
Also, Craig, you were kind enough to supply us with a very nice PowerPoint demonstration. We put that up on our website. If you look at the tonight's episode entitled Rejecting the Keystone XL Pipeline and What's the Matter with Mercury, you'll see the link at the very bottom of that, so you folks can take a look at that themselves. And are you going to be referring to that on Sunday as well?
And if you can't make it out to All Souls, that talk will almost certainly be broadcast on the All Souls Forum
in a couple
of weeks or whatever, whenever it comes up. I'm not sure how far behind the All Souls Forum is right now.
So,
our broadcast.
So will you?
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's fine.
Yeah. Okay. And so thank you very much for joining in. Any other information that we haven't gotten out yet, Craig?
No, I don't think so. I think the there's a lot of details about what kind of fish you could eat, but that's a whole other program.
Yeah, we'll get that up on the Facebook.
Yeah, right.
Links to that on the Facebook page. Just go to Eco Radio KC on Facebook.
Yeah, thank you very much, guys, for coming in tonight, and we certainly appreciate that, and we'll try and keep on top of this issue. And Craig, I know you'll keep us posted if they later come out and say, maybe you should eat fish once a year.
Yeah. Why bother?
Yeah. So we're going to go now to Natural E with the calendar. Thanks again, folks.
Thanks, Mike. Kansas City's Environmental Management Commission meets on Wednesday, May 14th from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Rivergate Center on the second floor, which is located at 600 Broadway. The Environmental Management Commission promotes environmental awareness and resource efficiency to the city's leaders and staff to assist the progress of Kansas City towards sustainability. The general public is encouraged to attend and observe meetings and to join and participate in its efforts. We mentioned earlier, End Big Oil's Democracy Pollution, Say No to the Keystone XL, put on by 350KC, who Mr. John Kerman is with this group. And they meet at the J.C. Nichols Fountain at Mill Creek Park on Saturday, May 17th. Kansas City will join communities around the country to ask President Obama and local officials to reject the Keystone XL pipeline, offshore drilling, and other dirty fuel projects that threaten our communities and destabilize our climate. Environmental Missouri, a book written by Don Corrigan. All are invited to attend a reading by and discussion with Don Corrigan, an award-winning author and journalism educator at Webster University. This free event will be held at 6:30 p.m. Friday, May 16th at the Peace Nook, which is in downtown Columbia, Missouri. Corrigan is the author of three noted outdoor and environmental books, all focused on Missouri. His latest is Environmental Missouri, so that is on May 16th. And then on May 24th, the March Against Monsanto will also begin at Mill Creek Park on the plaza at noon. And there'll be a couple speakers and a march through the plaza. And you can find more information about the march on their Facebook page. Search for March Against Monsanto. And that's all.
A couple of other things just to clarify. The march that we're the action this Saturday is at 2 p.m. On the plaza. And then also Don Corrigan, the author of The Environmental Missouri. He's going to be Mark Heim's guest on Evening Edition, which is a program on our sister community radio station, KOPN in Columbia, Missouri. That's tomorrow night at 6 p.m. KOPN.org is where that streams. And so thank you very much for giving us those updates. And do stay tuned. We're going to cover, we'll find out more about the March Against Monsanto on next week's program. We're going to go out now with David Rovick's song called Pipeline.
As soon as they started drilling for oil, they started building pipelines on the seabed, through the forests, and across the border lines. As soon as they started laying the pipe, they said, we'll do this safely. There will never be an accident. We can do this carefully. But the sands shift, the ice melts, disasters are routine. Point out their record of destruction, and they'll say their hands are clean. Point out their woeful deeds, and they'll consult their banker and say it's safer to use a pipeline than an oil tanker. So now they want to see how far their madness it can go. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. The tar sands line the north beneath Alberta's ground. As the price of oil rises, the oil men have found. Now there's profit to be made in a madman's dream by drilling deep beneath earth, blasting it with steam, bulldozing the land, melting what's inside, a record of extinction 1,000 miles wide. But laying waste to the northern plains is evidently not enough. The capitalists need markets where they can sell this toxic stuff. So across the farms and prairies, the oil now must flow. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. Governors oppose it. Every native band, ranchers don't want it passing through their land. Union leaders have denounced it, as have the rank and file. The president delayed it for just a little while. They say you can't stop progress. I hope that isn't true, cause if we mine the tar sands, if we let the pipeline through, it will be a pipeline to oblivion, a pipeline to the end, a pipeline to a future with nothing round the bend, a pipeline to a future that I hope we'll never know. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. A pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. Pipeline from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico.
Why is the American audience for poetry so small, and what's being done and what might further be done to change this? Poet William Trowbridge is finishing his term as Missouri's Poet Laureate. He will discuss this issue and others. He'll also be reading from his new book, Put This On, Please, New and Selected Poems, on this Wednesday's All Souls Forum right here at noon on KKFI.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Están escuchando KKFI 90.1 FM Kansas City, Radio de la Comunidad. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.